Good morning and welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to those of you who know that there's something dreadfully wrong with the political and religious institutions which govern and influence our nation, and who recognize that the considerable malfeasance inherent in the media, the military, and global economic influences is contributing to the problem. We realize that these institutions are indeed the cause of the issues that we are enduring, which means they are not the solution. Therefore, our mission is to look behind the headlines so that we know who is perpetrating the tragedies that are besieging our planet. Because based upon the plague of adverse political, religious, military, and economic influences, we have at most 15 years until all hell is unleashed. A complete economic collapse, world war, unrelenting propaganda, and the death of billions. As a result, in our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since His guidance regarding His covenant provides the only escape. Our phone number, toll-free, is 877-300-7645. The tragedy that has been wrought by Typhoon Haiyan, which is the most powerful storm ever recorded, the pictures from it are indeed troubling. You know, you see some 650,000 people are displaced. More than 10,000 are dead. Tacloban is essentially destroyed. The thing that troubles me about all of this is, what on earth were people thinking? What on earth was the government doing? What on earth was the media saying? This storm was known to have sustained winds of 200 miles an hour, making it the largest, most intense typhoon or hurricane in recorded history. And it was known to have those winds, and it was known to where it was going to strike 4 or 5 days before it hit land. I remember reading about the storm as it was in the middle of the South Pacific, moving its way towards the southern Philippines. It was obvious it was going to strike. It was obvious that with the, particularly in a place like Tacloban, which is a western or an eastern-facing port, that it was going to have a storm surge. It was going to be in the 10-foot range as it struck. There was no way to avoid that. And if you look at a topo map, topographical map of Samar Island, which is the island where Tacloban is located, what you find is that the entire island to the east of the port town, which is on an isthmus, low-lying area, it's a mountain range. Just west of the city is another mountain range, not quite as significant as the one to the east, but the one to the east is massive. Now, while there was no saving people's homes, with 4 to 5 days worth of notice and with a 20 miles distance at most that they would have to have traveled to high ground, why is it that so many individuals were stayed there, that they didn't take, you know, tarps and a food supply and some water with them? Why wasn't public transportation made available to take people to higher ground? It would have been a, you know, 30-minute to an hour trip to the mountains. What were they thinking? Well, many are not thinking now. We know that at least 10,000 are dead. The number could be massively larger than that as it swept through such a wide area of the Philippines. And this is really what we have come to expect. I looked at a survey of the massive storms that have struck over the last 10 years, and we are really in an epidemic worldwide of typhoons and hurricanes. We're in America, in particular, in a pandemic of tornadoes, the most deadly, massive tornadoes in the nation's history. ravaging the South and the Midwest. This is a serious increase in these storms, and also over the last 10 years we've had major epidemic of earthquakes, particularly of earthquakes greater than 8 on the Richter scale. Now, while I have spent a considerable time on this program proving that man-made global warming is a complete myth, that does not mean that our planet does not go through periods of severe weather and of a rise in the frequency and magnitude of earthquakes. And that is what we're experiencing. And that is what we should continue to expect to experience over the next 15 years. And we're also, during this time, going to find governments less able to help their citizens. They're completely and utterly inept in the Philippines. You look 4 or 5 days after that typhoon struck, and you don't see the existence of any government operations in those areas. What's going to happen even in the United States as we become ever more indebted and therefore unable to do anything productive for our citizens. Last week when I was having a discussion with Craig Smith, who we hope will call in later in this first hour, I suggested that the Federal Reserve is counterfeiting U.S. currency to buy bonds through QE3 at the rate of $1.1 trillion a year, which is greater than our current annual deficit, because no one else will buy them. Choosing to buy a treasury is motivated by two things. Either that the concern is that the overall economy in the world is so dire that governments have taxed and regulated businesses to the point that there is no hope for the majority of them, and that other nations are inflating their currencies, deflating their values at such rates that a safe haven is required. That's one reason. The other reason is because the United States is currently the world's reserve currency, something that will not exist much longer. And therefore, every nation has to have some U.S. treasuries, some U.S. dollars, because its foreign trade is conducted in dollars, something that's not going to last very much longer. I decided to look at the U.S. treasuries and U.S. debt, and I have some information that you might find interesting. Currently, the U.S. has $11 trillion in outstanding treasuries. Now, you might say, wait a minute, $11 trillion in treasuries, those would be treasury notes, bills, and bonds. And you might say, how is that possible when the published U.S. deficit debt is at $17.1 trillion? Well, not all of the U.S. debt is financed by treasuries. In fact, a significant part of U.S. debt is actually intergovernmental debt. This realization that the quote-unquote trust fund for Social Security and Medicare, even though they are now deficient, are robbed each year. So that the money that over time has been paid into Social Security and Medicare has been spent every year, and more even than that, by other federal agencies, including Department of Defense, for example. And so the trust fund, rather than having monies that have been paid in and that are earning interest in it, actually is a debt. In fact, the debt now to Social Security, I think, and Medicare combined is about $5 trillion. That's why when people say, I deserve my Social Security, I deserve my Medicare because I paid into it for a year, it's my money, I earned it, I deserve it. And I say, no, it's not true. You know, money was confiscated by way of taxes from your payroll check. That's true. But that money was spent. And it wasn't all spent on previous retirees. It was spent by the federal government, squandered. That money's gone. That's why I had that whole show saying, you know, if you set aside $1,000 a year for your retirement, but spent $5,000 of that money a year by borrowing to buy fast airplanes and fancy ships and boats and all manner of other toys and other indulgences, then you don't have that money to spend when you retire. It's not only gone, but it's in place of where it was, or rotting toys and billions of dollars worth of debt. So last week I did suggest that the Fed was buying treasuries because no one else would buy them. It appears that might be true. I looked first at who owns U.S. treasuries. That's always an interesting statement. You know, we claim that U.S. treasuries are mostly owned by Americans. That really isn't true anymore. But here's the breakdown. China owns $1.3 trillion of U.S. treasuries. Japan, which is a country on the verge of bankruptcy, and it's on verge of bankruptcy for lots of reasons. I mean, Japan right now is going through the most massive monetary creation scheme that any nation has ever embarked upon. It owns $1.2 trillion of U.S. treasuries. Caribbean banks collectively own $300 billion or 0.3 trillion in U.S. treasuries. So, you know, after China and Japan, it essentially falls off the planet in terms of who's the owner of U.S. treasuries until we actually get to the United States entities and the Federal Reserve. But China 1.3, Japan 1.2, all Caribbean banks combined at 0.3 or 300 billion. Brazil is at 300 billion. The OPECers collectively, Saudi Arabia, you know, Iran, Iraq, collectively, are 300 billion or 0.3 trillion. Taiwan is 200 billion. Then the nations of Switzerland, Belgium, the UK, Luxembourg, each own about, as nations, each own about 200 billion in U.S. treasuries. When we return, we'll consider the holdings of Russia, Hong Kong, Ireland, even the Philippines, and what it all adds up to and what it means to you and I. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about who owns the United States, with China being, for, in terms of foreign nationals, the largest owner of the United States, $1.3 trillion, and then Japan at $1.2 trillion. The OPECers are actually down at $300 billion. In the $100 billion apiece category, you find Russia, Hong Kong, Ireland, Singapore, Norway, Canada, Mexico, Germany, Turkey, India, France, and Korea, averaging in at about half of that number, holding anywhere between 13 billion dollars and 40 billion dollars in U.S. treasuries. We have Thailand topping the list at 40 billion. The Philippines slightly beneath that. Sweden, Colombia, Australia, Poland, Netherlands, Italy, Chile, Israel, Spain, Peru, Malaysia, Denmark, and South Africa, dwindling down to 13 billion at the last of those nations. All other nations combined, 214 trillion, 214 billion, or 0.2 trillion. So that's the total ownership of U.S. Treasuries. We have now about 5.6 trillion of the 1.1 trillion owned by foreign governments. The Fed, interestingly enough, is the largest owner of treasuries. Yes, the Fed now, through quantitative easing, has purchased 1.7 trillion worth of Fed treasuries, and making it much larger holder than China. And there'd be no reason for the Fed to do that unless, in fact, the U.S. was insolvent. In other words, the U.S. could no longer find anyone to purchase its debt. It's also interesting that United States government agencies, if you look at state and local government employee retirement funds at 4.4% ownership of U.S. treasuries, U.S. chartered and sponsored institutions at 2.5%, state and local pension funds at 1.7%, and federal retirement funds at 1.4%, 10% of U.S. treasuries are owned by U.S. state and local governments, meaning that 25% of the U.S. treasuries are actually owned by either the Fed or U.S. government entities, further affirming that we aren't able to sell these bills on the open market at anywhere near the quantity that is necessary. And as a global currency war looms, it is likely that foreign central banks will be dumping treasuries en masse. And when that happens, and when there are other options to the U.S. dollar being the international reserve currency, we as a nation will be insolvent. It will become impossible for America to fund its own debt. Now, I thought it would be interesting also to take the federal debt and put it also in perspective of average American debt, something that most people are probably unaware of. You know that the average American is $225,000 in debt, and that the average American has less than $500 in savings. Has less than $500 in savings, and is more than $225,000 in debt. Individual American debt, on average, is comprised as follows. Credit card debt, bearing 15% interest, on average is $15,000. People have bought $15,000 worth of products they could not afford. The average mortgage for an American is $148,000. The average unpaid balance on student loans for Americans is $32,000. The average auto loan, this is a stunning figure. Rather than buying, you know, you're in debt. You got $500 in savings if you're an average American. You're in debt more than $200,000. And rather than buy an affordable car, even a used car, you owe $31,000 in an auto in your auto loans. $31,000 in auto loans, $32,000 in student loans, $148,000 in a mortgage, $15,000 on the credit card, totaling $225,000 in debt. The average American makes $53,000 a year and is $225,000 in debt. And that $53,000, $25,000 is cost of living. We have Craig Smith with us, and just as we are reaching the bottom of the hour commercial break, and when we return, I'll ask Craig to share his perspective on both personal American debt and the national debt and what it means for you and I. Good morning. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. We have Craig Smith with us. Craig is the founder of and the CEO of Swiss America, which is the gold standard. You can reach Craig and do business with his firm through buygold.com. Craig is also the author of many books, including The Great Debasement, The 100-Year Dying of the Dollar, and How to Get America's Money Back. Craig, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Yanni. Good to be with you.
One of the things that I began the program with is my dismay as to what happened in the Philippines. That storm, the largest in recorded history, was known where it was going to hit and how severe it was going to be, including the 10-foot storm surge 5 days before it struck land. And in Tacloban, within 10 to 20 miles of Tacloban, there are two very large mountain ranges which would have gotten everyone to safety. Why is it, you think, that people are reluctant to do the smart thing, which would be to first have a considerable amount of their savings in gold, and second is to have a survival package in backpacks that are ready to go, things, you know, like a tent, sleeping bags, several weeks' supply of food, water. We have all of those things in multiple places and in our homes. They're ready to go when disaster strikes. And why do you think they didn't go to high ground? Why do you think they were so unprepared that no one seems to have even these basic necessities set aside?
Probably to some extent apathy, Yada, the whole belief that it won't happen to me. And it's you bring up a perfect example of what happens when people knew it was going to happen and they had the opportunity to get out of harm's way, but they figured, it'll probably pass, probably won't be as bad. I remember years ago when I was a kid back east when the hurricanes would come.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd, you know, the front wall would hit and things would get calm and people start taking the boards off the windows. And next thing you know, mm-hmm. the back wall hit, which, as you know, is twice as bad as the front wall.
Right.
And people learned over experience. I'm much like you, Yada, in that I have several locations around the country because I have homes
mm-hmm.
that are all equipped with food and firearms and goals
yes.
and water
yes.
and
backup generators.
Well, two of them have backup generators.
Right.
And I absolutely believe that it's essential for me as a father and a grandfather
yes.
now to make
yes.
sure that I can take my family out of harm's way.
Yes.
And I really think, Yada, that most Americans really believe, you know, quote unquote, we're here from the government and we will help you. And yet little do they know that if something critical happens, like you and I both know is going to happen to this nation financially, the
Correct.
Government will be so overwhelmed they won't
Correct.
Be able to take care of you, and it will be us taking care of our families, which is how our founders originally intended it.
That is absolutely correct. And it is the only responsible thing to do. It's also
yeah.
how our Maker intended it. The family is number one. It should be the source of support and security and love and nurturing. And we have neglected that and turned over those responsibilities to a government that is grossly irresponsible. I think part of it, too, is this this normalcy syndrome, Craig, that most people have been conditioned to the deteriorating nature of our country and our economy now for some time, and they see it as the normal, and they can't envision catastrophe happening. But we are so close to national calamity in terms of our debt and our budgets and our economy and our monetary system that the normal could vanish and we could be in complete anarchy within 24 hours. Isn't that true?
Yeah, and it's interesting how you put that, Yada. I agree with you. It's the old, you know, frog in the cool pot of water and you slowly turn it up and it doesn't know it's been boiled to death. But Americans
yes.
have slowly but been conditioned to believe that, you know, somehow or another it's all going to work out. This time I don't think it is going to work out, and I'm very, very concerned about it. I know that you are, and you know what's amazing to me is I sit down, and probably very similar to your situation, I sit down with people that are very well educated, have incredible amounts of money. I'm, you know, talking, yes. you know, $50-100 million, and you sit down with people that have a Princeton education,
mm-hmm.
they're very smart in business, and you sit down and you show them these basic facts, and they go, well, you know, I'll think about it, and, you know, maybe I'll deal with it in the future.
What is $100 million worth when your monetary system collapses and your money becomes worthless?
Well, we know in Weimar Germany it became worth a loaf of bread. You know?
Yeah.
So.
And what happened in a country like Cyprus when the International Monetary Fund said they wanted to bail out the banks and the government, and they confiscated people's savings?
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, if you theoretically had $100 million in a Cyprus bank, you all of a sudden had $47.5 million in a Cyprus bank. And of course, yeah. most people can't think in those terms of $100 million. But let's say
beyond that, it's worse than that, Craig. Because even though that's what you were left with, you couldn't take it out of the country. You couldn't
sure.
use it. You had no access
sure.
to it. They wouldn't let you withdraw it. You
yeah.
you essentially went from the $100 million down to nothing. Because not only do they take 60% of it, they refuse to allow you to withdraw the remainder of it.
Sure, and I think that's the biggest concern right now, the whole idea of capital restrictions. You know, there was a white paper, I think you and I have discussed it before, between the Bank of England and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, where they both agreed in the future that from now on it won't be bank bailouts, it will be bail-ins. Most people don't understand that the money that you have sitting in the bank does not belong to you. And when you tell people that, it's a shock. They say, baloney, I put $1,000 in that bank. It's my money. No, it's not. It's the bank's asset. Now, what happens is the bank insures that $1,000 through the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. But as you and I both know, they have pennies on the dollar to cover all the deposits. And now the Bank of England, along with the FDIC, has agreed that from now on, the Cyprus model will be the model. In other words, yes, you'll have that balance in your account, but you will not have access to it. It will be restricted access. You will only be able to get, and in the case of Cyprus, I think it was 3,000 euro out in the course of a month. You will not be allowed to take it outside of the country. So if you go on a trip, you'll be unable to do that. And what does that all mean, Yada? That means that we have lost the basic premise that our founders bled, fought, and died for, and that is freedom. And I don't think the average person understands what the word freedom means anymore. I think they think freedom means to be able to do whatever the hell you want.
Well, let me ask you something scarier then, Craig. I don't think the average American is free anymore. And let me go over the average American's financial situation, and I think this is why there are too few people now that can make a difference. The average American isn't free because they're $225,000 in debt. They make an average of $53,000 a year, of which $25,000 is consumed in cost of living, and they're $225,000 in debt. $15,000 of that's credit card, $148,000 is mortgage, which are typically underwater, $32,000 in student loans, $31,000 in auto loans. They're not free.
No.
You know what the average American has in savings right now?
Not much, if anything.
$500.
No.
The average American has $500 in savings.
And you bring up a great point. If you look at it in theory, matter of fact, if you look at it in practicality, they are modern-day slaves because there is a bill against them, so there's basically an encumbrance against them, so they are a slave to something. And, you know, when I heard your intro going into the half-hour break, it reminded me of something. In my book on page 189, I write about a study that was done out of the North Carolina University by a couple gentlemen. And they basically said they did a study that if over the last 60 years we haven't allowed progressive manipulation of money and the regulations to have taken over America like they have and robbed us of our freedom, what the average American's income would be. Because you're correct. Today's average American income is $53,700. Yet, if we hadn't had 60 years of progressive regulation and money manipulation, that average income today, Yada, would be $377,000. Now, wouldn't that be interesting how that would have kept up with the cost of living? That would have not, that would have made sure you weren't in debt the way that you're talking about, and you would have been a free man. But
you'd be a free man.
Because our government decided you shouldn't be free. You're part of the collective. We are not free. We are not.
Now, for example, in this if you use the average American, $53,000 in annual income, you say it's increased slightly since my number's $53,700 in annual income, $25,000 is just cost of living expenses. Therefore, they have approximately $25,000 a year that if they were to donate 100% of their net for 10 years, they would be able to pay off their debt, which means that for the next 10 years, the average American is an indentured servant to whoever they owe that debt to. In this case, banks, the U.S. government in terms of the loan, the U.S. government even in terms of mortgages and banks on their credit cards. The average American is an indentured servant for the next 10 years if they were to choose to be responsible and pay off their debt in the next 10 years.
Yeah, and what we're leaving out of that equation is taxes. So obviously they don't have to get the amount that you mentioned. But you bring up a great point, Yada. You know, there was a book written 30 years ago by Ari McMasters entitled No Time for Slaves. And the premise of his book was that it doesn't surprise him that the average American cannot keep up with what's going on because he's so busy on that treadmill of just trying to pay the mortgage and the car payment.
Correct.
And his student loans that he has no
Correct.
Time to pay attention to what's going on in the world around him.
Correct.
But we better start paying attention, Yada, because I don't mean to be melodramatic about it, but I think you would agree with me on this. We are losing this nation, and I don't think
Correct.
Most people
Quickly.
See it in those terms.
Quickly. I mean, I can't tell you, Craig, if we have 5 years, 10 years, or 15 years before America is a dictatorship. We're in total anarchy. The nation is completely bankrupt. And I think I know how it's going to play out. I just can't tell you if it's going to happen in 5 years or 15 years. But our outside window of survival is 15 years. That's really where we're at.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair prediction. And you know, it's kind of like the recent debt ceiling. I mean, the Kabuki mm-hmm. theater that was there was crazy because when you think about it, if you look at executive orders that were done under Bush and now that could be done under Barack Obama, all Mr. Obama would have to do is declare a national emergency and the Federal Reserve could make the deposits into the government
Correct.
Accounts overnight, just like they did with the $16 trillion they did in foreign bank accounts. So,
right, but
I mean,
for them to buy bonds or to make those deposits, which they're doing right now at the rate of $1.1 trillion a year, they have to counterfeit. I mean, they have to do what would be illegal outside of the Fed. They have to make pretend money. And they're using this pretend money counterfeit to provide that funding. So when they do it, it devalues everything we all own. It devalues our bank accounts, our savings accounts, the values of our homes, everything.
Absolutely correct.
We talked about the average American is 10 years in debt, a slave to their debt for at least 10 years.
Sure.
If they do, which I remiss. We're having a conversation with Craig Smith, who is the founder and CEO of Swiss America. You can reach Craig and make the wise decision to invest in gold, our precious metals, and prepare yourself for the coming collapse by just simply entering buygold.com. In the internet. Craig, I want to run down some numbers with you. Can you verify if you think that they're in the ballpark? The United States currently has a total debt of approximately $17.1 trillion. Is that true?
That's what the reported number is as of the other day, huh?
Okay. And that state and local government is in the United States. So United States state and local government debt is approximately between $5 trillion and $5.1 trillion. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. So that's $22.1 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. All right.
Yes, sir.
As of last quarter, the unfunded mandate, which is the which would be a debt by any rational standard, but if you were in a business, it would be called debt. If you were an individual, it would be called debt. That is. Legal
liabilities.
Where you have committed to pay a certain amount of money. It's it could be either through Medicare or through Social Security, which make up the majority of it. That are unfunded mandates total of $45.8 trillion.
And I think that number is low. I've heard numbers as high as $200 trillion. I think it's somewhere around $88 trillion, personally.
Yeah, it could well be. But there's no question. In fact, the number of 45.8.
It's at least that number you cited.
Yeah.
I mean, at minimum, for sure.
Yeah, the $45.8 trillion actually comes from the U.S. Treasury Department as of last quarter. So based upon what they view as Social Security, Medicare. The reason I think your number is correct, by the way, is because we have fundamentally changed Medicare and Medicaid, which is the largest contributor. Three-quarters of that number is Medicare and Medicaid. And we have fundamentally changed it, making it vastly more expensive. So as of Obamacare, the $45.8 trillion is no longer even close to being right. But let's use the lower number.
Sure.
The math, 17.1 plus 5.1 plus 45.8 is $68
mm-hmm.
trillion. Dollars. $68 trillion. That's how much America is in debt. That is, by the way, 435% of GDP, which makes us, as a percentage of GDP, the most in debt nation on Earth.
Correct.
The next most in debt nation is Greece at about 170% of GDP.
Yeah, and what's amazing about these numbers you're citing as you're saying them, And yet mm-hmm. we still have the reserve currency status in the world. How long yes. is that going to last, John?
Well, that's, I view, and I'd love to have on a subsequent interview with you, I would love just to focus on what's going to happen in terms of when the U.S. is going to lose its reserve currency status and what that's going to mean.
I don't know. Right, so, I don't know if I want to have that discussion with you. I'll have to go into rehab for 6 weeks after that one.
Yeah, that was the most frightening one. That's the one that's 24 hours where we're in a state of anarchy in the United States.
Absolutely.
Right. Now, let's just return to the debt for a moment. Let's say that we want to get the U.S. debt, including unfunded mandates with Social Security and Medicare, down to $8 trillion, which is where it was about 7 years ago. We want to get it down to $8 trillion, and we want to do it over, you know, the longest home loan is about 30 years. We want to amortize our debt down to $8 trillion over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
This is what that would mean. If the U.S. citizens of the United States were to say, we're going to do the right thing. We want to take our national debt down to $8 trillion, where it was about 7 years ago, over the next 30 years. What we would have to do is the following. It would mean that we would have to reduce the aggregate debt of $68 trillion down to by $60 trillion to leave it at $8 trillion over 30 years, which is $2 trillion a year. Now, the total revenues of the U.S. government last year were $2.4 trillion. That's the total revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if you're going to write down the debt, pay off the debt at $2 trillion a year, of that $2.4 trillion, you're left with $400 billion to spend. The rest of it's going to go to amortize the debt. You're left with $400 billion to spend. The federal budget last year was $3.8 trillion. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right on the money.
So if you divide $400 billion, which is what we'd have to spend, over $3.8 trillion, isn't it about 10% of the U.S. government that can be funded, requiring 90% reduction in the amount government spends every year to reduce the debt down to $8 trillion over the next 30 years?
Yeah, you know, here's what's amazing. I love how you're laying this out, Yada, because you don't have to be as smart as a fifth grader, nor do you have to be a CPA to realize that the numbers don't work anymore, and the only people that don't recognize that are the 435 numbskulls called in Congress.
Boy, is that ever the case. We can add a few more numbskulls to those in the Federal Reserve, to those in the Senate, and to those that occupy the White House. And unfortunately, Craig, I think from both parties. I'm not sure that the Republicans are any better at this than Democrats. Thank you, Craig Smith. BuyGold.com.